Welcome back to the second part of a multi-part series on the life of William Marshall. The first episode that I did was on the concept of how great men require a combination of good fortune and competency. And this episode is going to look at something else. It's going to look at how great men like William Marshall were able to play what I call the long game. And the long game refers to this idea of, I think you'll be able to understand this pretty easily, this idea that your actions don't address the immediate situation, but also the situation in the future. Meaning, you're doing things that you know will pan out for you better in the long term than in the short term. And you'd be surprised how many people tend to lean towards the immediate. Their inability to look beyond the immediate moment. They react to what they see, and they don't understand that what they do then is going to have long-term consequences, for better or for worse. And they tend to also live in the moment as opposed to living with a plan for just what, you know, long term. And what's also interesting and fascinating and just speaks to the high intelligence of someone like William Marshall, let's resummarize essentially his background. He was not the firstborn son of his father, John Marshall. So he was never going to inherit anything from his father. His older brother was going to get it all. And up until this point that we've been discussing him, he's been kind of an obscure knight. Not very well known. And he has now been taken in by Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was the queen wife of Henry II. And this really changed his fortune. What ended up happening is his son, Henry II's son, so Henry the Younger, he ended up engaging in a revolt against his father. William Marshall, of course, sided with the son because he was under the son's, I guess, context important. Henry at the time had been the younger, had been crowned king to basically clarify the succession. So if something were to happen to Henry the Elder, there wouldn't be any question of who was going to be king. Here's the problem, though. He was a king who had no land, who had no kingdom. Meanwhile, his other brothers had titles, estates. Richard the Lionheart had lands that he controlled in France. And so Henry the Younger decided to revolt against his father. The revolt failed. And actually, this is what, as a 21st century American, I find this very odd. But, you know, your son engages in combat and violence against your reign, and you end up losing, and the father is actually rather generous to you. And that's kind of what happened. I mean, he was essentially had his wings clipped politically, but he was given an allowance and was essentially allowed to live, you know, he was controlled to an extent, but he wasn't like thrown in prison. Well, eventually he got bored, and he also got tired of the fact that he wasn't really advancing as a king. He didn't have any lands to control or govern. He wasn't doing any governing, and yet he held the title of king. And so he decided to go to France and participate in the tournaments there. Henry II did not allow tournaments in England. He thought that they were not good ideas, but he allowed his son to go to France. William Marshall went with him. And that I could dedicate a whole podcast episode to their tournament exploits. I mean, we believe William Marshall unhorsed, I think it was between 300 to 500 knights in these tournaments. This wasn't the jousting tournaments that you're thinking of from like traditional movies or something like that. This is more of it's more of like a war game. Now, what made it so, it essentially became the equivalent of a professional sport. And the reason is because if you unhorsed a knight, you owned everything. You owned his armor, you owned his weapons, you owned his horse, and he could buy it all back, or you got to keep it. And so you can imagine how quickly someone like William Marshall was able to basically build up a lot of wealth. And there were people who were, it was a controversial thing. I think the church was opposed to it because of it was violence. But guys, let's be honest. You have a ton of men who've been trained for war and there's no wars going on. So what do you do with them? They get lazy and bored and then they go do stupid stuff. So, you know, jousting tournament is a, I think that this is why Henry the Elder didn't oppose Henry the Younger doing this. He's like, well, better than doing revolts back home. So the two became very successful. But here's the thing is William Marshall became built up wealth from jousting and the tournaments. And he didn't just spend it all frivolously. He didn't get, you know, that poverty mindset. But we really see his long-term thinking after he got back from the Holy Land. He'd gone there because Henry the Younger died. I mean, this is all, I'm skipping over a whole bunch of stuff. Trying to get to the point of this episode is, you know, he goes to the Holy Land, spends a few years there. He comes back. Henry the Younger has died during, after another, I believe, failed revolt. And Henry II, the elder, gives William this estate in Cumbria, and which is actually technically controlled by an heiress. I don't know how to pronounce her name, so I'm not going to, but she was this young woman and was given to Marshall as his ward. So what this effectively did is it completely transformed William Marshall's fortunes. He went from being a relatively well-off knight to now he had a title and an estate. And remember, this was a guy who in his younger years was a nobody and had no prospects of ever becoming wealthy. It's kind of like you take somebody who's been poor and then they win the lottery. But the thing is, it's when they win the lottery that you realize, and I'm not saying that that his competency had nothing to do with it. I'm just saying his fortunes had changed so rapidly and so greatly that you then discover who the person really is. Do they spend all that money or do they make rash decisions? So King Henry's thought is, I'm going to give him this estate and he'll marry the ward when she gets older. And then that'll be his title. And this is the part where it really shows William Marshall's ability to control his, for a lack of a better term, his impulses. Because you think for a guy like that, he'd play the safe game and say, yeah, marry the girl when she becomes of age for marriage, and then you'll have the estate, and then you've got it secured. William Marshall actually does not do that. He educates and raises the ward, the heiress of the estate. He does not marry her, and they become friends, and he's friendly towards her. And, you know, it's all speculation because we don't really necessarily know what Marshall's thinking was, but his attitude was that he didn't need to marry her because he, as long as she was his ward, he controlled the estates. He it was effectively his until she became of age to inherit it and officially take over. And he wanted something greater. And he was still young. He was, I think, in his 30s at the time. So he's like, you know what? I can afford to play this out. And he continues to remain loyal to Henry II through a bunch of whole different crises that occurred during his reign. And finally, during King Henry the Elder's, you know, dying days, he promises to give Marshall the in hand of marriage this woman named Isabel, who was this young, she was in her teens at the time, but she controlled a vast estate. And we're talking essentially, he now had lands in England, Wales, Normandy, and Ireland. So he went from being a knight with no title. So this was a guy who in his, you know, early 20s, late teens, was an obscure knight with no wealth, no title. He wasn't going to inherit anything. And now he's effectively become a millionaire in, you know, in medieval times. He's become a multimillionaire. And he became the Earl of Pembroke. So he's known as the first Earl of Pembroke. So he became an earl as a result of this. So this is what happened because he played the long game. He didn't immediately marry the first girl that who had title or opportunities for him to, you know, have an estate. He knew that if he kept playing, and I don't want to say play the game, but he knew that if he maintained the way he was doing things, that greater opportunities would come along. And this sounds a little opportunistic, you know, oh, you're marrying this girl for wealth and stuff. I think people need to understand medieval times, especially, I'd say, among royalty. I don't think that this was at all the case among the gentry, the peasants or serfs. I don't think that they ever really thought of this. But when you're dealing with somebody who's inheriting as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, you're inheriting castles, lands, people who live on it, people who have to work on it, you know, so marriage doesn't just mean it involves more than just two people. And to add to that is that Marshall and Isabel, you know, William and Isabel actually had had a happy marriage. So this wasn't him. And for all we know, he may have just not been interested in the heiress when she became of age to marriage. And who knows, you know, we have no idea what she looked like. He may have just not been interested in her on top of that. So, but of course, he never met Isabel before he married her. So this is where, like I said, he waited things out. And this was only a couple years after he had returned from the Holy Lands is when he got married. So he waited a few years and was able to secure himself. And what this means is also you have, back then, owning land was a big deal, having castles and estates and titles and all this stuff, because you were able to provide for family. I think that we have this idea that, oh, you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and you're entirely dependent on yourself and you don't ever get anything from family, and this very I want to say like the opposite side of the nepotistic coin, you know, the one where basically you favor family even when you shouldn't. Well, then there's the you don't favor family even when you should. So, I mean, we could speculate what would happen if William had married the other gal and inherited the estates in Cumbria. But I think this just speaks to his ability, his character as a man, where when he was offered something, he wasn't being greedy. He just realized there are other opportunities out there. He wasn't, like I said, he didn't have a poverty mindset. You know, and to give a very crass example, and it's not crass, it's just, it's a crude, I'd say crude example, is the lottery. Because when you win the lottery, you have the opportunity to take a chunk of money immediately. You know, let's say it's like a $12 million lottery winning, Powerball, whatever. I don't play lottery, so I don't know. But let's say it's $12 million. And they say, we'll give you a lump sum right now of like $6 million. Or you can receive the $12 million in monthly installments for the next, you know, 12 years. So you get $1 million a year. From what I've read, most people who win the lottery go bankrupt within a few years. And I'd have to look at the studies to know why. But my guess is it's people who don't know how to handle their finances. And this goes back to what I was saying about how great men require a combination of good fortune and competency. You can't just have good fortune because you don't have the competency to take advantage of the opportunity. Whereas William Marshall, whenever he had an opportunity, he played the long game. He was thinking long term. He was thinking, you know, he was always thinking about how to expand his lands and titles, and that way he would have something for his kids. I know we talk about it with irony and snark and sarcasm, but he was very much concerned about his legacy, the legacy of his family. And we can do another podcast episode on this, the irony of how it ended for the Marshall dynasty. But, you know, he, in his lifetime, built up a very great dynasty. But this is because he was able to, when he was given opportunities, he made wise choices. So, going back to the whole lottery comparison, is it's somebody who says, you know what, I'm going to play the long game. I'm going to take the monthly installments and not take the lump sum because I'm going to get $12 million as opposed to six. And I don't need that money right now. And so it's showing long-term, what is it called? Low time preference and impulse control. And he also, this reflected in his relationships with the kings that he served. I mean, William never betrayed a single king that he served, and he served at least five. Every time there was a revolt, he sided with the king that he had pledged loyalty to. And I think that this is an example of where Marshall was playing, I don't want to say being, he wasn't being opportunistic, he wasn't being conniving. I think he was just being wise. There was the revolt that Richard led with the King of France against Henry the Elder, so Richard's father. And in the waning days of the king's war, he was losing this war against his son Richard. Many nobles left Henry the Elder to go join with the rebellion with Richard. William was not one of them. He refused to leave the king, and he was there when the king died. Here's the interesting part, though, is when Richard the Lionheart became King of England, and he started, you know, basically governing the country and dealing with the different noblemen, he rewarded those who remained loyal to his father more than he did those who came over to his side, because these were people that he knew would be loyal to him basically through thick and thin. Like, he knew that guys like William Marshall, if there was a revolt against his rule and he was not doing well in the war, William was a man that he knew would be reliable and dependable to the end. This is not a guy who was going to abandon him. And I don't know if William thought that way specifically. I think that he did in some ways. He realized, you know what, being faithful to whoever you're fighting for may not play out in the short term, because it didn't benefit him in the short term serving the king, because, you know, everybody's like, well, we got to go over to the winning side so we can take advantage of it. And I think William knew, if I betray the king and leave him, that means that I'm not trustworthy. I mean, he even did this with John, King John, you know, yes, evil King John of Robin Hood. William remained loyal to him throughout all the different rebellions that occurred during his rule. He didn't like the guy, but he knew better than to defy him. He knew that John was more powerful and that John had his problems, as, you know, people can read about. But William was smart enough to know that in the long term, rebelling against him or falling out of favor was not a good idea. So to kind of go, you know, circle back to the whole idea of long-term thinking, this is what long-term thinking enables you to do, is you're able to navigate all these different relationships with people who are not exactly the most morally upright human beings and not necessarily the most emotionally stable. Where William knew not to say stuff or to keep his mouth shut or to remain silent or to avoid a confrontation or conflict. And there, you know, we could go into the whole details of his, how he was able to navigate dealing with King John. But the reality is that his behavior made it clear to even the people, the kings who didn't like him, like John, or didn't get along with him all the time. They realized that this was a guy who was reliable and dependable. He developed a reputation for just being known for fidelity to whatever king. So John knew that this made him indispensable. It made him indispensable to Richard the Lionheart, because William Marshall is the only person to have unhorsed Richard the Lionheart in combat. Now, there's more to that story that you can read about. I don't want to go too much into the stuff because I think people really need to read the book, The Greatest Knight. But Richard had reasons to be a little unhappy with William over that affair. And in fact, I think this is another example of where William was able to play the long game, Richard the Lionheart. After his father died, he assumed the kingship. He confronted William about the affair. And what had happened is William had stabbed, his lance had gone into William or Richard's horse and killed it. And so Richard had been unhorsed. And Richard accused William of trying to actually kill him rather than hit the horse. And the author of the book makes a good point. So this put William in a bit of a conundrum. If he admitted that was true, then Richard could hold it against him. Now, if he said that wasn't true, then he'd be accusing the king of being a liar. And William chooses, very important moment. Like, what are you going to do? And William decides to actually tell the truth, or, you know, say what he thinks, and says, Richard, if I had wanted to hit you, I would have hit you. You know, like, this is the greatest jousting champion in the entire Christendom telling you, if I'd wanted to kill you with my lance, I would have, my lance would have hit the target. Like, I didn't miss. And Richard kind of chuckles and says, you know, let's not talk about it anymore. Like, he's made his point, but this is, again, where this guy knows he's not going to agree. He knows how to say something that in the long term is going to keep him out of trouble. You know, he was not prone to, William was, you know, you're reading this book and you realize William was not a man who was prone to rash decisions. He wasn't he wasn't unpredictable. He didn't just do random stuff. His predictability actually is what gave him such a fierce reputation to where nobody wanted to fight him in combat, because he would repeatedly throughout his life do a challenge of trial by combat. People would question his character. They'd question his loyalty. And he'd say, I will do a trial by combat. He did this up into his 70s or 60s. And none of the young knights would touch him. So this is an example of where a man's a predictable and well-known reputation can be effective. And it goes back to knowing how to play the long game, where you make decisions that you know that in the long term will benefit you more so than making decisions that benefit you in the immediate. You know, for example, leaving the king to go side with his son Richard during the rebellion. He knew that in the immediate, it might be beneficial, but not in the long term. Just like not like marrying that heiress of Cumbria, that would have been beneficial in the short term. But by waiting it out, he was able to marry someone who had even more estates and more wealth and gave him more. And this is the important part, I think, that people are missing when they say, well, that sounds very materialistic, whatever. It gave him the power to stand up for things that were right. He was able to, I mean, this is the part that people miss. If you don't have the power to do something, then you can't do it. And we all, this is where a lot of people tend to be, they have this weird, I think that Lord Acton's statement that power corrupts is not a help. I think that that's caused a ton of problems in our society in certain sections of the political sphere, where they're just terrified of power at all. They think having any power is bad, as opposed to the idea that if you don't have power, your vision for what you want around you can't occur. They always seem to have this effeminate, I'm tangenting, guys, just, this is one of TJ's tangents. I need to come up with like a little logo, TJ's tangenting, brought to you in part by Honda Rebels. This idea that power, you go get someone who's evil and has the power, and then you change them, you know, you basically you influence them, you manipulate them get them to do what you want, as opposed to taking control, taking power, and then using that power to enforce what you want to have happen. You know, they treat power like it's the ring of power from Lord of the Rings, and this is where Tolkien's books, they're great books and great stories. They're not a direct reflection of everything they're not allegorical for everything in life. You know, don't you want power? No, power corrupts. No, it doesn't. I mean, it's like going back to this whole thing with, well, you know, you give a man wealth, he's greedy before he gets the wealth, or he's not greedy. Wealth doesn't make men greedy. Just like power doesn't corrupt, it just reveals character. The same way that giving William these opportunities, it revealed who he actually was. Circumstances don't change people. They reveal who they are. In many cases. I'm not saying that in all cases. You know, if you're in a war like World War I, that changes you. That doesn't necessarily reveal, it can, like, Ernst Jünger's Storm of Steel shows, like, this kind of revealed who Jünger was, which is a good book you should also read. These things all revealed who William was. That his circumstances changed, but he didn't change. So I think that that's all we're going to talk about for this podcast. I've done a couple tangents, which are requisite, I think, for my podcast. So hope you enjoyed listening to that one. The first one is up on my website, tjmartinell.com. I'll be doing a couple others. I'm not sure how many I'm going to do, because I may come up with new ideas as I do more podcasts. So hope you enjoyed listening to it, and talk to you later.